Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Whether it's nuclear weapons, depleted uranium, or just old-fashioned risky reactor fuel with no place to go, Canada is the world's number one supplier of deadly uranium to the world. In fact, one company, a former government-supported corporation called Cameco, is the world's biggest uranium producer. Cameco found the richest uranium deposit ever, kind of a Saudi Arabia of the North, underneath a lake in northern Saskatchewan province. Environmentalists and native groups warned about the dangers of tunneling under a lake to dig up highly radioactive material. But the leftist government of Saskatchewan, with plenty of federal cheerleading and money, approved the project. On October 23, 2006, the whole tunnel filled with water. Expensive giant protective doors failed to work. The multi-billion dollar project is in recovery mode and not expected to open before 2011 or maybe even 2014. It is one big mess. We'll hear more about all that from our next interview guest, Jim Harding. As uranium jumped from $7 a pound around the year 2000 to over $70 now, small exploration companies are trying to drill into radioactive deposits all across Canada. The Kettle River Valley and the Okanagan area is threatened by exploration for a uranium mine. In 2006, a coalition of environmental, community, and Aboriginal groups formed Uranium Free BC Coalition to stop it. That's at uraniumfreebc.org. The Aboriginal Inuit government in Labrador is deciding whether to accept or ban new uranium mining there near the coastal community of Postville. They fear contamination. In Ontario, hunger striker Donna Dillman heads into the second month of her hunger strike to protest a proposed uranium mine north of Charbeau Lake in eastern Ontario. Now in a wheelchair, this grandmother has moved her protest to the chilly steps of the Ontario Legislature in Toronto.
Being a grandmother and not wanting to leave the kind of legacy that we're heading toward, I felt I had to act. And I actually heard one of the native leaders speak to a reporter and tell him that we could live for a long time without food, but clean water is essential to all life, and felt like, well, I could go for a long time without food if it made the point.
Keep up with Donna Dillman's struggle at www.ccamu.ca. Across the country, Canadians are fighting to keep radioactive materials below the ground where they belong. At the heart of it, right in Saskatchewan, is activist Jim Harding. We have him on the phone now. Today we're going to investigate Canada's deadly secret with author Jim Harding. The subtitle is Saskatchewan Uranium and the Global Nuclear System. The book is published by Fernwood, and the foreword is by the famous anti-nuclear activist Dr. Helen Caldicott. Jim, for those outside Canada, can you tell us where Saskatchewan is and why a relatively quiet part of Canada should matter so much to the rest of the world?
Well, Saskatchewan's in the prairies with Manitoba to our east, Alberta, the big oil province to our west. And we are known for grain in the southern prairies, but the truth is the mineral non-renewable industry in the north is actually what's driving the Saskatchewan economy. And it's the location of some of the earliest uranium mines in the 1950s that provided fuel for the nuclear weapons of the United States. Even that history back that far isn't widely known yet.
Well, how did Canada set out to become part of the nuclear weapons game?
Well, we were involved in the Manhattan Project almost from the beginning. Port Radium in the Northwest Territories, which initially was mined for radium, was reopened to mine for uranium that now is known to have provided the fuel for the weapon dropped on Hiroshima. So there was a direct connection into the Manhattan Project that produced the first A-bomb in terms of uranium. But the Chalk River plant, actually the precursor to the CANDU reactor, it actually produced weapons-grade plutonium for the Manhattan Project and later for the sort of growth of the nuclear arsenal. So we've been in there on both ends, the uranium fuel end and the reactor technology end. And of course the CANDU went on to be from my perspective, infamous because the technology that went to India and then to Pakistan is the basis of both those countries becoming nuclear armed. And of course, we're in that is one of the dangerous places on the planet, along with the Middle East.
Well, Canada even trained one of the world's worst nuclear terrorists from some people's perspective, Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan, the father of the bomb in Pakistan, they call him. Mm-hmm. He was trained at the Bruce nuclear plant in Ontario, mm-hmm. and then covertly leaked secret nuclear plans to Libya, North Korea, and Iran. So it seems like once you start this game,
yep.
Even though you're talking about peaceful nuclear power, in fact, it heads out and becomes weapons again.
You know... What we have to learn very quickly, because of course the nuclear industry is again promoting itself around the climate change issue, and I'm having to address that question with a lot of people, but what we have to learn is there never was a distinction between the weapons and the commercial side of the industry. And I keep saying that to people over and over because I have had to say it to myself. When I wrote this book, I found as I got further and further into the history and connecting dots that I hadn't really taken the time to connect, possibly because it's pretty frightening stuff to work with, I realized that I'd been a bit suckered myself into buying into this separation. There is no separation. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is supposed to guarantee nuclear technology only for peaceful purposes, doesn't actually prevent the uranium and the nuclear fuel cycle from going from the commercial to the weapons. And we've tracked that down, and I discuss it in the book. But in the case of Saskatchewan, we know all the uranium in the 50s and the 60s went directly into weapons. Then the Non-Proliferation Treaties declared in 1970, and from then on, all the government said, oh no, it's only going for, quote, peaceful purposes. Well, of course, a nuclear reactor is not peaceful in the health or environmental sense anyway, because studies do show increased deaths from leukemia from children 9 and under adjacent to nuclear facilities. Those are international studies now. But from the point of view of weapons, you can take the uranium from Saskatchewan, go into enriching facilities in Kentucky in the States, which, by the way, are coal-fired and creating greenhouse gases. And then all the depleted uranium left after the enriching, which is about 90% of the mass, is available to the military, and that's not controlled by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So we now know that DU goes into military reactors. They create weapons-grade plutonium. The DU is the casings for H-bombs, and the DU, of course, is going into the bullets and the uranium weapons that are actually being used and have been used in the last 5 wars. So we just have to start saying this as loudly and clearly as we can, because we are, in Saskatchewan and Canada, directly involved in these low-level, what I think really is a low-level nuclear war in certainly Kosovo, Bosnia.
Well, sure. We've spread all kinds of nuclear materials in Iraq through these mm-hmm. Nuclear tank shells, the depleted yeah. uranium stuff. Well, how much of the world's uranium does Saskatchewan provide?
Well, we're at the top. If Cigar Lake, the biggest mine and highest grade uranium in the world, comes on stream at all, they've just flooded again, and maybe Mother Nature's not going to keep the uranium in the ground. But if it comes on stream, Canada could be pushing up to 35 or even more percent of the world production. We're at certainly a third now. And Australia would be about 20%. So just Canada and Australia themselves are well over half. And, of course, that's one reason I wanted to link this analysis of Saskatchewan into Helen Caldicott and the Australian people, because they're earmarked to become the next big front end if the industry gets its way and expands nuclear through, you know, this period of time. But
two countries, you know, people who think they're very nice, and they are yep. nice people when you meet them,
yep.
Still allowing this nuclear club to keep pushing this dangerous material out into the world. How does that happen?
Well, you know, I'm hoping the change of government in Australia, and we can hope for one here, will be just a little move in the right direction. Howard, who was defeated, was very much in the same camp as Harper and Bush. And some of their plans, which have surfaced since this book was published, but I've continued writing on it, this global nuclear energy plan of Bush's had Howard and certainly Harper on side. And what it looked like they were moving to, because Saskatchewan and Australia were the big uranium suppliers, was to maintain a monopoly on the nuclear weapons technology in the existing nuclear powers by taking waste back to Australia and Canada and building enriching and reprocessing facilities in those countries so that they would be then enabling uranium to go in to expand nuclear power commercially but maintain the weapons grade material for the U.S., etc.
So we could be a nuclear colony then.
And if we were to fulfill that scenario, yes. And, of course, we would be battling the nuclear waste issue in northern Saskatchewan.
So they want to bring waste back to beautiful northern Saskatchewan and dump it there?
Well, the proposal to build a new generation of CANDUs in northern Alberta, it's a piece of proposal at Peace River, and secondarily at Whitecourt. When we looked at the design plans that the AACL was promoting, those reactors would be designed to, in fact, take back spent fuel, including from the light water design of the U.S. and the French system. So since Areva, which is the biggest nuclear corporation on the planet, the French company, is also active in northern Saskatchewan, and building up nuclear waste all over France at the sites of their 60 or so reactors, yes, we're being a bit suspicious that it looks like we could be one of the northern Canada, in the prairies, could be one of the international sites that gets targeted, and all in the name of replacing a little bit of natural gas in the oil fields and supposedly that contributing to reducing the risks of climate change. I mean, the pretenses of these things we've learned are usually public relations to try and get politicians and the public opinion on side in terms of some kind of economic spin-off. But behind the scenes, the more research we do, we do find that the nuclear weapons connection is usually there.
Well, I've been seeing some ads that say that nuclear power is the answer to climate change, and, you know, it doesn't emit so much carbon. Doesn't it work out as far as carbon dioxide goes just to build some nuclear plants?
Well, even Jeffrey Simpson said that in his Globe column yesterday, which surprised me, but he's sort of paraphrasing one of the members of the UN Intergovernmental Joint Panel, which has been raising awareness about the risk of climate change. It is true, if you compare a coal plant to a nuclear power plant and don't look at the nuclear fuel cycle, that you'll get far less greenhouse gases. But if you add the whole nuclear fuel cycle in, it's certainly very debatable. There are some people who actually say if nuclear power was expanded to replace coal, that with the shortage of high-grade uranium, which is a non-renewable, we'd be back into such energy-intensive mining to get sufficient fuel that we'd almost be back to the same levels of greenhouse gases, because the mining end and certainly the enriching end are extremely energy intensive. And of course, let's not forget what kind of fossil fuels go into building the cement and the steel for the nuclear power plant. So it is I don't want to say it's a silly position, because it is having some effectiveness in terms of public relations. But it's a thoughtless position. They clearly aren't looking at this thing systematically. The other side of it is, of course, if you were expanding nuclear to make a small dent in greenhouse gases, you would be increasing the chances of proliferation, which we've just talked about. So those risks certainly should be pushing us towards the renewables. And the economics of nuclear is just horrendous. The hidden subsidies.
Oh, it never pays for itself. It's just, billions and billions of dollars keep going down the tube while they tell us how cheap it is, and the government has to insure it or it wouldn't work at all.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say the conclusion I've come to after looking at this is the only reason why these different nuclear states would put so much public backing into this technology to make it appear to be competitive, because it's probably about a third of its real cost when you look at the insurance subsidies and the outright subsidies. Like AECL just got another $500 million from Harper for cleanup. It has nothing to do with any new source of electricity. Simply cleanup, because Chalk River is contaminated and White Shell in Manitoba. And we're starting, of course, to see just the extent to which the contamination of the nuclear technology has affected us.
Jim,
Hope is contaminated. Cameco has been shut down. That's the uranium refinery. I've just read the study from Albany where they did use depleted uranium for production of weapons-grade material, and they've gone back and they found the civilians living there any period of 10 years in the last 23 since that plant was shut down have extremely high levels of rare cancers. So we're starting, slowly we're starting to actually go back and look at the impacts in terms of nuclear waste. And I don't just mean nuclear reactor waste. I mean waste at every point along the cycle. And those costs are basically invisible when nuclear electricity is costed. But the governments, of course, are willing to back electricity and make it appear to be cheap because of the weapons connection. That's the only thing that makes it make sense.
Well, as we speak, grandmother in Ontario is in about day 45 of her hunger strike. I'm worried about her, Donna Dillman, in order to prevent uranium prospecting in eastern Ontario.
Right.
We have another group here in British Columbia in the Kettle River Valley trying to fight off more uranium prospecting or a uranium mine. Can you tell us about the ecological impact of uranium mining in Saskatchewan and maybe a little bit about the miners themselves?
Yeah, and let's remember the reason why these new sites are being targeted is because with the price of uranium skyrocketing, just like oil, as non-renewables, it's, of course, now becoming profitable to go after the lower-grade ores because Cameco, in northern Saskatchewan is mining, and Kojima, the French company, very high-grade ores. But now lots of other investors want to get in on it because there's a short-term buck to be made. But the long-term legacy is what we ought to be looking at in terms of sustainability issues. And the nuclear, the tailings waste is where the bulk of the radioactivity remains. Those become available to the biosphere in ways that they aren't when they're left in the ground as hard rock. Of course, uranium is a natural element. But it doesn't spread into the aquatic systems and the airborne sort of pollution that occurs with the tailings. There's been major, major spills at the uranium mines in northern Saskatchewan, things that in the public inquiries in the 70s that approved these mines were said to be impossible, of course, were possible. Key Lake spill, 84, Wollaston Lake, huge spill, 89, and now the Cigar Lake underground mine has flooded. So even the drilling into the high-level uranium rock creates vents for radon gas to come out. And one of the hearings in 93 in Saskatchewan actually recommended against the mine going ahead, which the government of the day did not listen to, because of such things as 600 holes drilled deeply into high-grade uranium ore, which were venting alpha radiation, which if you breathe much of that, your risks of lung cancer go up. So basically, uranium mining makes the radioactivity in the geology where the uranium is available to the biosphere. And I always say, here we are, we're being pretty stupid because we produce chemicals that create holes in the ozone which increase the ultraviolet radiation on human and plant life. And then we bore holes into the radioactivity in the earth which make that radioactivity available to animal and plant life, all when we could be just moving with renewable, non-polluting technology. But of course, these non-renewable industries have, for reasons of weapons and for reasons of the power of the oil industry, have been running the show for a long, long time. So there's a mindset that we have to change, a fundamental change in mindset, which of course is why this battle over nuclear is so important. You know, we don't want to get distracted with this notion that nuclear is somehow the answer to global warming, because we're going to get locked more into this high-cost technology, the radioactive waste, and we're not doing what the Brundtland Commission on Sustainable Development was arguing, because we're going to make things rougher for future generations, not just with climate change.
But well, for thousands of years, they're going to have to look after our mess just so we can power our Game Boys here. This isn't...
And they won't be getting electricity. I keep pointing out to people, we're getting very short-term benefits and they're getting very long-term burdens. And from a justice perspective, it's just simply wrong. And it's taking a while to get that message through.
How can people find out more about Canada's nuclear game and the groups who oppose it?
Well, there's networks forming very quickly again. I'm quite amazed. You know, all the environmental groups, provincially, the Saskatchewan Environmental Network or the Saskatchewan Environmental Society or the Sierra groups, they're all moving alternative energy information now quite quickly. And that Ontario network, I think, has built connections all across the country where the woman is protesting.
Donna Dillman,
yeah.
Yes.
And I'm sending them material regularly, and I'm going to go down and do some workshops down there after Christmas. The beyondnuclear.org site in the States, doing really good work. World Information Services on Energy, WISE, has sites and does very good work out of Amsterdam. You know, if you just actually Google non-nuclear or anti-nuclear now, you'd be just amazed. I mean, my stuff's moving probably faster. The information that I've done sort of based to build up this book is probably moving more through internet articles and commentaries than it is through bookstores, which, you know, is clearly a good idea. I mean, books matter, but boy, sure, an awful lot more information seems to be moving on the internet.
Although I really enjoyed the book, I think that it's helped me draw together a lot of things that were sort of put all over the net, but there it is tight in one book, and it's really your lifetime's work that's coming out here. It's called Canada's Deadly Secret, Saskatchewan and the Global Nuclear System by Fernwood Books. How can people find that book, Jim?
It should be in most of the independent bookstores now. I know in Victoria, Munro's carrying it. I'm not sure in Vancouver yet who is, but it actually, when it was released in late October, one of the guys at Fernwood was monitoring the Google site on new books, and it was in the top 10 and then the top 20 for several days. So clearly it's out there somewhere. I know in Saskatchewan, I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if 400 or 500 have sold already, which is actually very good for that market.
Well, that's good news. Jim Harding, thank you for sharing a little radiation with Radio EcoShock. And this is Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for calling.
That was Jim Harding, one of a growing chorus of voices against uranium mining in Canada. You have been listening to the All Environment Radio EcoShock Show with Alex Smith. Tune into our website at www.ecoshock.org for tons of free materials. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Thanks for caring. Here is another clip from songwriter Celia. Find her at myspace.com/Celia Online.
The government's got global warming covered. We're entitled to destroy, consume, and clean. Hello, there has got to be a better way. And pass it on. Well, there are lots of kinder ways to mother. This world's already gorged with hungry children. Oh, 200 species
community writes the show.